Right, so we're going to be looking at section 4 of the study week notes tonight, which is God developing us for the kingdom. Now, this is probably the best section in all the notes. It's the best section on Elijah. No, seriously. It's got so much exciting stuff. It's awesome to see the way Elijah grows and develops and the way that God works with him and the way that God develops him for the kingdom, and also the lessons that we can draw, and we can see how God's developing us for the kingdom as well. And hopefully we'll see that, as James says, Elijah was a man just like us. So we can relate to him, we can see his struggles and his difficulties, and we can grow from the lessons that he learnt as well. So we'll just try and get a bit of an idea. Well, that didn't work. Okay, so we'll just get an idea of the story so far. So where are we in Elijah's life? So in 1 Kings chapter 15, Ahab became king, and he provoked the Lord to anger by serving Baal and also in his marrying of Jezebel. And it says that it wasn't a big deal for him to live in the sins of Jeroboam. So Ahab was an incredibly evil man, and the sins that Jeroboam committed in bringing Baal worship and the Ashtaroth into Israel were multiplied a lot more in Ahab. Now Elijah saw that Israel had turned from God, and he prayed for a drought to try and get them back on track. So Elijah saw the desperate situation that Israel was in, and he wanted to do something about it. And he came and he pronounced judgment on Israel in the start of chapter 17. And he says, there'll be no rain because of the way you've been behaving before God. And he hears from God and he goes to Cherith and he hides out there and he's fed by ravens until the river dries up. And then he hears from God again and he goes to Zarephath and he lives with the widow for many days. And while he's there, God provides food for them, and also he heals the widow's son. So he's been off in isolation after he's announced that there's going to be a drought in the land. And then he hears from God again, and God tells him to go and confront Ahab. And while he's doing that, he goes to find Ahab, and he sees Obadiah, because Obadiah and Ahab are out looking for land to find some grass for their flocks, so they don't have to kill them because there's just no food left because of this drought. And after he sees Ahab, he goes and he tells all the people that they're going to have this massive contest up on Mount Carmel. And this is what we looked at in the last group. And we saw that Israel turned back to God and they say, great is God, great is God. And the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Ashtaroth are destroyed by Elijah. And Elijah prays for rain on Mount Carmel. And then Elijah, he's fully pumped and he runs back to Jezreel right next to Ahab while Ahab's riding in his chariot. And the hand of the Lord was with Elijah. So we can see that Elijah's been off by himself. He's been in isolation for quite a long time, about 3 years. And then the rains finally, he comes back and he has that battle with the prophets of Baal. And all the people turn back to God. And you can see also that all the way through Elijah's life, God was directing his path. So God told him to pronounce judgment on Israel, and then everywhere that he goes to the River Cherith, he goes to Zarephath to see the widow, and he goes to see Ahab, meets Obadiah, all under the direction of God. So God is controlling his life, and he's been away from people for a long time. So he feels like he's doing the work of God, and he feels like he's been away from the people for such a long time. And then finally, he's given this opportunity to convert all Israel. So he'd be pretty excited and pretty pumped about the situation. And then in chapter 19, we come to the section that we're going to look at tonight. And we start off with now Ahab. So who can tell me what sort of a person Ahab was? What sort of a king was he? A what? Yeah, he was evil. Anything else?
Weak.
Yeah, he was very weak. Yep, he was quite possibly one of the weakest and most pathetic men in the Bible. And we can see that all the way through in chapter 18, verse 4. It was Jezebel that destroyed the prophets of the Lord. And in verse 19 of chapter 18, it says the 400 prophets of Vashtaroth and the 450 prophets of Baal who ate at Jezebel's table. He's the king, and it's referred to as Jezebel's table. No mention of Ahab there. And it's the same in chapter 21 when Ahab covets Naboth's vineyard, and it's Jezebel that goes and does all the legwork because he's just crying on his bed like the pathetic, weak person that he is. And Ahab, he comes to Jezebel in verse 1 of chapter 19 and he tells her all that Elijah did. Now, Ahab knew that this was the work of God. And does he come and does he say to Jezebel, does he say, this is what the people said. The people said, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. No, there's no mention of God. He tells Jezebel about Elijah and about the prophets. He doesn't say the prophets of Baal, he says the prophets. So he still has this affinity with Baal. Even though he's been through this whole experience up on Mount Carmel, he still has this inkling back towards Baal, and it's probably also because he's frightened of Jezebel. But we need to ask ourselves the question from Ahab's reaction. Do we take our opportunities to tell people about God? It's easy in situations to word things so that people don't really know what we believe and don't know what we're on about. Like, for example, I've just started work at a new work. I've been at a new job. I've been there about 6 weeks probably. And I've started playing indoor cricket with the work team, with all the boys. And it just happens to be on a Thursday night. And they said to me this week, they said, oh, you're playing indoor cricket Thursday night? We need you. It'd be fun. I played the last 2 weeks. I was like, oh, no, actually, I can't come. Like, oh, why can't you come? Oh, I'm doing a Bible talk. They said, what? I said, oh, I'm doing a Bible talk. And it's not that you don't want to be proud of what you believe and like the fact that you do love God and that's something that you're happy to talk about, but you always know it's going to be followed by that awkward silence. Like they say, oh, what are you doing? Oh, I'm doing a Bible talk. And then what's a tumbleweed doing in the workplace? Like, no one wants to talk about it. And so I thought, oh, I don't. And anyway, I ended up telling him and I said, oh, yeah, I'm doing a Bible talk. It should be pretty good. And a few people asked me about it. And then as I left work tonight, there was about four or five guys from the office said, oh, good luck with your Bible talk tonight, mate. So you just never know the reaction that you're going to get from people. And there's good and bad. Like, I was on the train yesterday and I was doing a bit of study for tonight and I was just reading my Bible and the lady sitting next to me, she saw my Bible and I knew that she could tell I was reading a Bible because I watched her read a couple of pages with me. And then she pulled out a piece of paper and the bit of paper had a couple of quotes on the first page and she turned it over and on the next couple of pages it had praying for ministries overseas and there was one on South Africa. I thought, oh, this is perfect. I've just come back from South Africa. I'll tell her all about it. And I'm like, actually, it's going to be awkward. I don't want to say anything. It's nearly my stop. I should really pack my Bible up. And I didn't say anything to her. It was a perfect opportunity to share my faith with her and I totally wussed out. And so there's good and bad. Like we always have these opportunities to share our faith with people, just like Ahab did here. And it's really easy to take the easy road, and not tell people what you believe, and not put yourself in that awkward situation. And I think the only way to really try and overcome it is to share your stories with people. Like even if you don't do something, say, oh, what about this opportunity that I had that I didn't take? And tell people about it. Or when you do take the opportunity and you talk to people, make sure you tell that to your friends as well. Because I think then when you're in the situation next time, you'll know that you're going to be talking to someone about it and it gives you a little bit more confidence. You don't really want to be telling people, oh, yeah, I had this opportunity, I missed out again. You want to say, oh, I had another opportunity like that other one, but this time I took it. So I think it's really good to make a good idea to make sure we always share those stories with each other. And because Ahab, he totally wussed out here. He didn't tell Jezebel about anything about God. And also he mentioned the prophets. He didn't call them the prophets of Baal at all. So then we get a bit of an insight in verse 2 into this woman, Jezebel. And what a disgusting beast she is. It says then in the start of verse 2. Then Jezebel sent a messenger. She's so swift and violent. She's ruthless, determined, and she's also courageous. There's no discussion with Ahab. You don't hear Jezebel here in verse 2. Oh, darling, I was thinking of slaughtering Elijah. What do you think? There's nothing like that. She doesn't ponder the idea. She's straight into action. And it's interesting to think that she doesn't just go and have Elijah killed too. She gives Elijah an opportunity to escape. She sends that messenger to him. And I think she probably was hoping that Elijah would flee, because she realised that all the people had turned to him in the previous chapter and all the people were looking for God. So to kill him probably would have been politically not the best decision to make. But I'm sure she would have found a way if that's what she had to do. And she says something very interesting. She says, "So let the gods do to me." And you sort of can see in Jezebel's reaction that it has more to do with her love for Baal and for those prophets of Baal. It has more to do with her personal feelings, her personal attachment. In all of Israel, she's set up these places of worship to Baal, and she's shown people that Baal worship is the way that she wants the nation to go. Now, to have this victory against the prophets of Baal would have deeply offended her, and it's kind of offended everything that she stood for. So it's more than just her belief in Baal, but it's a personal thing. And a couple of good verses just to think about when we're sharing, when we're talking to people about things that we think are wrong and the right path that we think they should be choosing. Someone want to read that for us? James 5. Does anyone have a crack?
I'll just read it on the screen.
Yeah.
"My brethren, if any among you strays from the truth and one turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save his soul from death and will cover a multitude of sins."
Okay, so James tells us that it's really important to tell people when they're doing the wrong thing. But at the same time, we have to remember this passage in Luke as well. Does someone else want to read that off the board?
"Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. And do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Pardon, and you will be pardoned."
Okay, so even though it's really important to point out to people when we think they're doing the wrong thing, the approach that we take is really important. It's not for us to judge or condemn. That's for God. But all we can do is point out to people what we believe is right and what we believe is true. We're not actually judging them as a person. And I think finding that balance between standing up for what you believe and judging someone is a pretty difficult thing to do, but something that we need to be careful of, because if you offend someone when you're trying to preach to them, they're never going to listen to you anyway, no matter how right you are. So if you try and jam something down someone's throat, they're just going to spew it back up later. So then in verse 3, we see the reaction of Elijah. And it says in verse 3, "And when he saw that, he arose." And every decision that Elijah has made has been with God in mind. I'll just get them all up there. Now, these are in your study notes. I don't know what page number it is, but there's a section where you can fill in for each of those verses. Every decision that Elijah makes is a decision from God. Even when he was up on Mount Carmel and he decided to have that battle with the prophets of Baal, it seems as though that's just some crazy idea that he came up with. But then when he's up there and he prays, he says, "Lord God, show the people that this is from you." So everything that he's done is from the direction of God. So what we want to ask is, why did he choose not to ask God or seek God's direction this time? What was it about this situation and about where he's at emotionally that caused him to completely forget about God?
He was scared for his life.
Yeah, exactly. He was scared. That's a really good one.
What else? Didn't believe God was in control anymore?
Yeah.
So did he trust God? What else?
I think think he thought things would go a lot smoother than they did. You know, he'd just come back from this massive victory, and then all of a sudden, like spineless Ahab, can't even stand up to his wife, and bang, everything's in his face again.
Yeah, so what would he say? Wasn't what he anticipated,
yeah.
Saying? Wasn't anticipated? What else? So what's another reason why Elijah didn't turn to God this time? Right, well, I think one that is worth putting up there, and you might not be able to see yet, but it's that he's incredibly judgmental. That's one of the reasons why he doesn't see God, and he thinks he knows he's on the right track here. And we're going to see that when we come to the end of this section that I'm looking at. The reason why Elijah gets up and flees south towards Mount Horeb is because he's incredibly judgmental. And he thinks he's got, and thinks he knows what's best for the people. So let's ask the question for us. What are some reasons that we don't turn to God? When we're in difficult circumstances, we always seem to try and sort it out ourselves or talk to other people. God sometimes seems to be the last person on the list of who we want to talk to about our problems and about difficulties. What do you think some of the reasons are that we don't turn to God?
Sometimes think he doesn't hear because he doesn't get a response straight away.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just don't think of him.
Yeah.
Might not be interested in your problem.
Yeah.
Too proud to admit that you have a problem?
I guess with that one too, Ben, sometimes you feel when you turn to God, like you feel like you need to sort all your problems out before you can go to him, like, oh, I can't go to him yet, I'm not ready to work on it. You know, I need to get into a right frame of mind and a right position before I can go to God, but it's quite opposite what God wants from us. He wants us to come and work it out with him.
Maybe that way to help.
Yeah, maybe. Few to think about unless anyone's got. See you guys. Have one? No? Sorry, I thought I was going to say so. Okay. So we want to pick up this idea of fear. Elijah was definitely afraid. And the reason that he is so afraid, I think, is kind of tied in with this wasn't what he's anticipating, didn't trust God. They're all sort of tied in together. I was just thinking of an example. One time, me and my brothers and the Egginsons were out on the back of the boat, and we were out getting towed on the bodyboards behind the boat. And me and Tom were out the back, and Tommy fell off, and we kept going a couple hundred metres up the river, and then I fell off, and they went back to pick Tommy up. And while they were back about 200 metres up the river, I kicked something with my foot just while I was floating in the water. I was like, oh, come back and get me, come back and get me. And then I was swimming and I kicked it again. I was like, please, come back and get me! Just started full on, just splashing water everywhere. And I go surfing a fair bit, and I always thought if a shark ever bit me, I'd just quickly grab it around the head, pop its eye out, and then swim to safety. Now, I've always had that plan in my mind, and I was dead set terrified. I just put my head down and just paddled as fast as I could. Because when things don't turn out the way we expect, we get... It's a really easy opportunity for us to get incredibly frightened and disheartened. And I think that's exactly what's happened to Elijah. And another example is, when we were growing up, we lived next door to a vacant block, and then a guy that lived just around the corner bought the block and decided to build his own house or have someone build the house. And while they're building it, he used to call around every afternoon and check on the house and see how it's going. And the house was about, I don't know, half finished, all the frames were up and that. The roof was on and they were starting to line it, and we could hear him coming on his Harley, and me and Sarah thought, oh, well, let's go scare him. We'll go hide in the house and make him think there's robbers in there. So as soon as he stopped his Harley and he could hear us, we chucked a couple of planks of wood and ran around the house. Except we didn't realise quite how crazy he was. He picked up a star post and started screaming and running around the house trying to find us. Me and Steve ended up out on the road just going, "We're so sorry." So when situations change and they're not what you expect, the automatic reaction is to be afraid and upset. And that's exactly what happened to Elijah. And there's a couple of good examples of why he was so afraid. And they're from the notes as well. There's a couple of quotes there. Someone want to read that first one from Psalms?
Yeah. "When I'm afraid, I'll put my trust in you. In God and his word I praise. In God I put my trust. I shall not be afraid. What can me and man do to me?"
Okay, so there's the first example. Elijah didn't have trust in God, so that's why he was afraid. And the second one?
"And he said to them, why are you afraid, you men of little faith? And he got up and rebuked the winds and the sea and became perfectly still."
Okay, so Jesus, when he's on the boat with his disciples and they started freaking out, he notices that they're afraid because they have such little faith. So that's kind of the faith-trust idea. And this one's really important. This one's 1 John 4. Someone read that.
"We have come to know and believe the love which God has for us. God is love, and the one who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. By this, love is perfected with us, so that we may have confidence in the day of judgment. Because as he is, so also are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. Because fear involves punishment, and the one who fears is not perfected in love. We love because he first loved us."
Okay, and this is what I really think Elijah didn't understand. The reason why Elijah is so afraid is because he doesn't have a good understanding of God. He doesn't have a good, solid relationship with God because he doesn't appreciate the love of God. And perfect love casts out fear. So if he had an understanding of God's love and care for him, he definitely wouldn't have reacted the way that he did. So he flees, and he flees south. And he heads south to Beersheba. I found this awesome map on the internet. Some guy's drawn some little pictures on there. You can see where he went to Cherith. There's like a little, raven that fed him. And then he goes up to Zarephath, and that's where he sees the widow and her son. And I think that's supposed to be like explosive fire burning his offering to God. And then there's crazy devil man. I don't really know what he's doing there. But anyway, so he flees and he comes down. He comes from Jezreel all the way down to Beersheba. And you can see it a bit better on this map. He comes from Jezreel up here, and he flees right, he's in Israel, and he flees right down through the guts of Judah, and he comes to Beersheba, right on the southern side of Judah. And he covers about 150 km in 3 days. So he's doing about, if he's travelling for about, so he's doing about 50 km a day probably. And he's travelling for, say, 10 hours a day, and then he's getting a bit of sleep as well. He's doing about 12 minutes every kilometre. So he's travelling about 5 km an hour. So if you think about, if you go for a solid jog, you're probably doing about a 7-minute K. He's doing a 12-minute K for 10 hours for 3 days in a row. So he's really motoring, and his poor little helper's trying to follow him as well. And they get to Beersheba, and the little fella's like, "Oh, I can't go on." So he leaves in there in Beersheba. And the reason that he came so far down is probably because Jehoshaphat, who was the king in Judah, had an alliance with Ahab in Israel. And he was probably worried that Jehoshaphat would find him out and help Ahab find him and take him back to Israel. So he comes to Beersheba. He leaves his servant there. And this is where the first sign of Elijah's depression starts to show. Because one of the key signs of depression is that wanting to be alone. You know, when things aren't going well and you kind of feel down on yourself, and it kind of feels good to be on your own and like, "Oh, woe is me. Nothing ever goes right for me." You like to ham up your problems and make them seem a lot worse. So I think that's kind of what Elijah's starting to do here, is he starts to think, "I'm better off on my own anyway. No one else will help me." So starts to show signs of depression. And these are some of the common signs of depression. A lack of concentration, small attention span, and these are all in the notes. mood swings, feeling sad all the time, self-blame, feeling worthless, hopeless and helpless, tired, lack of interest in activities once enjoyed, changes in performance, inability to make decisions, aggressive negative behaviours, physical aches, sleep and appetite changes. I don't know about you, but I reckon I have at least all of those every week. Look, that common signs of depression, I seriously would have half of them in a day, I reckon. But that's the difficult thing about depression. Like, I know someone really well, one of my good friends suffers incredibly with depression and they're on medication for it and everything, and they're not the sort of person that you would ever think would be depressed. And that's the worst thing about depression is it's so up and down that you, unless you really know someone, you probably never know that they're struggling with it, because when they're feeling good, that's the time when they're around everyone and that's the time when you see them. And when they're feeling down and depressed, that's when they're off by themselves. So you wouldn't really know that they're a depressed sort of person anyway. It's just like Elijah, it's so up and down and so inconsistent. So just one thing for us to think about is with people with depression and the difficulties that people go through is a couple of passages. One from Hebrews. Someone read that one.
Let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies having been washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful who believes. And let us consider one another to stimulate one another to love and to good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching.
Okay, so the whole idea of this passage hinges on this idea here. Consider one another to stimulate one another. And it's the idea of get to know each other so you can find out what makes each other tick, so you can encourage each other onto the kingdom. Find out about each other. Meet together. Don't not come and assemble together as some started doing. Meet together. Spend time together. Get to know each other so that you can help each other and build each other. And thinking about this idea of depression, it's really important that we do get to know each other so we can help each other out in the tough times. As Ecclesiastes says, two are better than one because they have good reward for their labour. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he does not have another to help him. So in Christadelphia, there are always going to be people that will knock you down. That's just human nature. There are people that will treat you badly, people that will do the wrong thing by you. But hopefully there's going to be enough of us that there'll be at least one there that can help pick you up. Two together are better than one. So we should be trying to establish those relationships with each other and help each other along. But Elijah, he chose to be by himself. And he went a day's journey, so he keeps heading south. He's on a mission. He's on a mission down to Mount Horeb, and we'll see why at the end of the session. And he heads off into the wilderness. I always imagine, whenever I see the word wilderness, I always think about like this massive tropical forest. And I imagine this dude with a big machete just hacking his way through the wilderness. So I thought I'd put a couple of photos of the wilderness in Israel. It's like complete desert. It's like a full dust bowl. There's a couple of little plants down the bottom. But so just to get an idea of like he's just trekking through this massive desert, like just trekking for 3 days, going 150 km, and he's only a third of the way there. And then he keeps going and he comes to a juniper tree. And I found a picture of a juniper tree. That's it there on the right. And that's more wilderness. So he comes to this juniper tree. You can imagine how stoked you'd be to find a juniper tree in the middle of that. So no wonder he collapses under it. And apparently, there's a couple of passages in Job and in Psalms that tell us that the roots, even though they're nauseous and bitter, they are edible in times of drought. And there's just been a massive drought. There's been no rain for 3.5 years, and then there's been a massive downpour. So there's probably a bit of water flowing in these gullies and stuff. But ultimately, the land's still going to be dry. There's not going to be any trees around, apart from the occasional juniper. So I imagine like these roots, like he just sees this juniper and he's struggling and he's completely knackered and he just falls underneath it. And he might try and dig up the roots a little bit and he gets half up and he's chewing on this root. And he just goes, seriously, God, just take me away. This is pathetic. I'll die, thanks. And it says, in the literal translation, it says that he begged that God might take his life. He thought that it was all useless, and the depression completely takes over. And I don't know if this totally applies to the life of Elijah, but the notes talk about him feeling suicidal and the depression completely taking control of his life. And I don't know if Elijah was necessarily suicidal here. I know I've had times in my life when things don't go right, I think, oh, just kill me. I'm better off to be gone. And it's only a short-term thing that passes. But I just wanted to show some suicide statistics. These are a few years old. 2004 these are. But it just makes us realise that suicide is a serious thing that we should talk about a bit more. Like, I was even just putting this slide together and I was like, oh, this is a bit heavy. It's going to be a bit awkward talking about suicide. Because it's just something you don't really feel comfortable talking about. But it's something that happens, like, just to so many people. Around 2,000 Australians commit suicide every year in 2004. That's almost 2% of Australian deaths. That's 22% of all deaths of Australian people aged between 20 and 34 years. And it's 27% of Australian males aged between 25 and 29. So 30% of people, of men who die between 25 and 29, it's from suicide. Australian males are 4 times more likely to commit suicide than females. And for every suicide in Australia, there are 30 attempts. So do the math on that. You've got 30 attempts for every suicide. There's 2,000 suicides a year, so there's 60,000 attempts in Australia. And divide that by about 300 to work out how many in a day, and that's about what? It's about like... 60,000 divided by 300, what's that? 60,000 divided by... That's like 200 people every day trying to kill themselves in Australia. How full on's that? And suicide is the leading cause of death among 15 to 24-year-old Australians. And there are 8.5 more deaths by suicide than by homicide. So you imagine when you go out the door, your mum's like, watch out for yourself out there, dear. Because seriously, you're more likely to kill yourself and get killed by someone else. 8.5 times more likely. And I guess the same idea applies to suicide as it does with depression. Like, we just really need to get to know each other. I know personally I've had two of my friends, good friends, that have committed suicide. And they're not the sort of people that you would think would ever take their own life. They're people that, when you hang around them, they're a lot of fun to be with. And it's only when you're not around them that they slip into that depressive mode. And if you didn't know them well, you probably wouldn't even know that they were struggling and thinking along those lines. And both of those guys had over 200 people at their funeral, so they weren't guys that didn't have friends and didn't know people. So it's so important that we get to know each other well, like that passage in Hebrews and Ecclesiastes, work together so that we can help each other out. We really need to get to know each other and build those strong relationships to help each other overcome these sort of difficulties in our lives. And Elijah goes on at the end of verse 4 and he says, I'm no better than my fathers. He wants to die and he thinks, I'm no better than my fathers. And he's alluding back to, he's wandering through that wilderness and he's obviously thinking about the children of Israel when they were in the wilderness. And there's a passage in Numbers chapter 11. Someone want to read that? Hey?
Mel,
go on. Okay, so this passage is taken from Moses looking after the children of Israel and God's providing manna for them every morning. And the people are like, seriously, we've had enough bread, we want to eat an animal. And they start whinging in their tents and say, oh, I'm so sick of bread, I just want some meat. And Moses says, like, God, I can't put up with these people, this is very average. If you're just going to leave me with these people, I'd rather be dead. And so Elijah's mind goes back to the people wandering through the wilderness, and that's exactly how he feels. He feels like, I'm just so pathetic. You had this plan for me. I couldn't do it. I've let you down. He just feels so empty. And that depression just takes over his body. And in verse 5, he lies down under the juniper tree and sleeps. And behold, an angel touched him and said unto him, arise and eat. Now, I love how, like, this story of Elijah, like, so many crazy things happen, and you just sort of read over and go, oh, yeah, yeah. But imagine you're sleeping under a tree, like, you're completely pagged out, you've just run, like, 1,000 kilometres, and this angel just taps you on the shoulder and goes, have a feed, go on, I've prepared something for you, get up and eat. And he just goes, oh, yeah, yeah, good call. See, well, imagine you're sleeping and an angel just taps you and wakes up, you freak out of your mind. But this angel is actually a bit of a wake-up call for Elijah, because Hosea is talking about the time of the prophets, and he says, I've also spoken by the prophets, I've multiplied visions, and I've used parables by the hand of the prophets. So around the time of the prophets, there wasn't a lot of... Angels weren't seen very often. It wasn't very common to see a story about an angel in the time of the prophets. And that's because God was speaking through his prophets. So this angel being there is kind of a little slap in the face to Elijah, saying, hey mate, you're not actually doing your job. So I've had to send a ministering spirit unto you. And in verse 6, Elijah gets up and he looks, and there's a cake baked on coals. How stoked would he be? He's just been sleeping and he gets woken up to this lovely little cake and a glass of water. And he did eat and drink. And you wonder... You wonder what he might have seen when he sat up. And I reckon it definitely would have been one of Auntie Nancy's angel cakes. And he did eat and drink. It's awesome to see Elijah's stuck in this pit of depression. And it's really fantastic to see the way that God treats him, the process that God goes through with him. Because I know with my experience with people with depression and friends that have gone through hard times and that, you sort of just want to slap them in the face and go, mate, I don't really want to hear about it, just get over it and we'll move on. But it's not how we should treat people that are really struggling. It's so important that when people are depressed and down and in difficult situations like Elijah was, that we use the same approach as God did. And what he does is, from this verse, the first step is that he provides the material needs. So when people are down and struggling and in depression, the most important thing that we can do is provide their material needs. Provide them food, provide them sleep, and provide them shelter. Because until you provide those things, you're not going to be able to help them with their depression. So the first and most important thing is to help them with their material needs. And the second step is in the next verse, where it says that he had 40 days and 40 nights on the strength of that food. Now, where he was going from where he was under the juniper tree to Mount Horeb was nowhere near as far as he'd already come. It was about a third of the way. And he had 40 days and 40 nights to make that journey. So God gives him time to recover. And that's the second important step with people with depression, is give them the material needs, then give them time to recover. And also, we're going to see in Luke's section that he gives Elijah the opportunity to talk about his problems. Like Elijah comes and says, oh, I'm the only one left. And God doesn't straight away just say, shut up, you're not actually the only one. He lets him get it off his chest. Even though he's wrong, he lets Elijah talk about his problems. And then the third step, which is also in Luke's section, is he gives him a focus and direction. So now that he's given him the opportunity to recover and talk about his problems, he then gives him a focus and gives him something to do, gives him a purpose. So that's the three-step approach that we need to be thinking about taking with people that are in difficult situations and in depression. And the angel of the Lord in verse 7, he comes to him a second time. So he pags out again, and the angel wakes him up again and says, arise and eat, because the journey is too great for you. So he wakes him a second time, and I think the lesson for Elijah here is you need to be a bit more patient with people. Elijah just wanted people to turn around at the drop of a hat, and he wanted to turn on his first approach to them. Like, he wanted the people, all right, I've pumped you up now, let's serve God. Same with Ahab. He wanted him to be turned around and not be fooled by Jezebel. He wanted people to turn straight away. But God's sort of teaching him, even you, the great prophet, you need to be fed twice. It's awesome to see the way God's working with Elijah. And the angel says, the journey is too great. So the angel knows that Elijah is headed down to Mount Sinai, which is Mount... What is it?
Horeb.
Yeah, Horeb. Yeah, that's the one. So in verse 8, he arose and did eat. And he went in the strength of that meat for 40 days and 40 nights under Horeb. And that 40 days and 40 nights is linking again to the story of Moses. There's an awesome connection between the story of Elijah and this story here of Elijah and the story of Moses. There's so many references to it. When I first saw the notes talking about linking with Moses, I thought, oh, it's a bit of a stretch. But the more I got into the study and the more I saw what Luke was going to talk about in his section, there's definitely a huge link between the last time that Moses was up on Mount Horeb and what Elijah's doing here. And if someone want to read Deuteronomy 9, verse 9?
When I went up to the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant which the Lord had made with you, then I remained on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water.
Okay, so that's Moses speaking, and he says, when I went up onto that mountain to get those tablets, I didn't have bread or water for 40 days and 40 nights. So there's definitely a clear link between this story and the story of Moses. And I just want to finish by having a look at a passage in Exodus 32 where Moses was up on the mountain getting those tablets, and he comes down from Mount Horeb, and he's still up there. And the Lord says to Moses, he says, go, get down, for your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt are corrupted. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made them a molten calf and have worshipped it. So Moses was taking too long to come down from the mountain, and the people started to get frustrated, and they thought, oh, we'll build a molten calf and we'll worship that. And they tell Aaron, they tell him, build us something to worship. So he gets all the earrings off all the girls and he builds this golden calf. And the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. And now leave me alone, so that my wrath may become hot against them, and that I may consume them. And I will make of you a great nation. And then Moses pleads with the Lord. He said, why does your wrath become hot against your people, whom you have brought forth? He pleads with them, and he says, please don't kill them. Remember, down the bottom here, he says, remember your covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants. And so this is a huge insight into the mindset of Elijah. When Elijah first got up and fled from Jezebel, he was headed straight to Mount Horeb. And he was headed there because of this passage. He was headed there because he remembered that God said, because they serve that molten image, I'm going to kill them. So Elijah says, well, look at Israel now. They've completely forgot about God. They're completely under the control of Jezebel. They're serving Baal. They're serving Ashtaroth. Never has there been a better time for God to wipe them out. So he thinks, nah, stuff it. I'm not hanging around. I'm going straight to Mount Horeb, and I'm going to try and remind God that it's about time he destroyed all of Israel. So we see there that Moses had the complete opposite approach to Elijah. Moses pleaded for the people's lives before God, whereas Elijah was headed there solely for the purpose of destroying the people. And hopefully we'll see in Luke's section that the way God manipulates the situation once Elijah gets to Mount Horeb is awesome. The way that he flips him around and tries to make him think like Moses had. Okay. Thanks very much, Jono. Doing the rest of the chapter, 1 Kings chapter 19, and we're also going to touch very briefly
on a pretty weird little chapter in 2 Kings chapter 1, where Ahab brings down fire and consumes a few people. I want to start off by asking you a couple of definitions. What's the definition of a comparison?
It's really simple, even one word.
Likeness.
Likeness, same,
similar,
and
contrast. Well, I only go with one word, that's all we need, just keep it simple. Contrast.
Different.
Perfect. Okay, so what was that last point? Mr. Blackwood, you look like you're listening pretty carefully and taking notes. What was the last point that Jono made? Past the depression bit? Someone help him out. Leisha. No, it wasn't about comparisons and contrasts. Good try, though. Exactly. Moses. Okay, and his last point was that at the time of Moses, God wanted to destroy the people, didn't he? Okay? And Elijah wanted to destroy the people like God said he was going to do. Moses, however, was saying, hey, hang off, don't destroy the people. Okay, so what we're actually going to be doing is we're going to be taking a little bit of a look at the man Moses. And the reason we're doing it is for these two reasons here. Okay? Moses is going to provide us a comparison in some ways, and he's also going to provide us a contrast. So for this section here in chapter 19, Moses is the best person to take a look at. So we're going to have a little bit of a look in detail before we even talk about Elijah, exactly what happened at the time of Moses. Okay, and before we do that, let's have a look at Romans chapter 11. There's a really, really good verse in Romans which gives us a bit of an insight into exactly what's going on in 1 Kings chapter 19. Okay, Romans chapter 11 and verse 2. Trina, are you there? Yep. Read it for us, please.
No, have not passed away from the people which have borne you. What you not what the scripture says of the life, having made intercession to God against Israel.
Okay, so is everyone reading that verse? Because if you're not reading it, it won't mean anything to you. What you not? Don't you know what the scripture said of Elijah, how he makes intercession to God against Israel, saying, when did Elijah make intercession against Israel? Lord, they have killed thy prophets and digged down thine altars, and I am left alone that they seek my life. 1 Kings chapter 19, he's making intercession against Israel. So that's an important point, just keep in the back of your mind as we're going to talk about Moses. Okay, where we left off was 40 days in the wilderness. And Jono's just made the point that Moses also spent 40 days without food and water on the top of Mount Sinai or Mount Horeb, which is effectively the same place. So at the moment, what we're having a bit of a look at is a contrast. Okay, so this is absolutely vital to understand exactly what's happening here with Moses and Elijah, but to appreciate the story of 1 Kings chapter 19. 40 days of contemplation. Alright, Moses had 40 days on the top of Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai, where he was given the tablets of stone to think about exactly what God wanted to achieve with the people of Israel. Elijah too. Has 40 days to think about God's purpose with the children of Israel. At the end of the 40 days, Moses makes intercession
For or against?
For.
For the people. And what does Romans chapter 11 say? Intercession. Exactly. Against. Right, so that's our contrast. Okay? So we're going to have a bit of a look at that, and then we'll get on to the comparison. So I actually did it the wrong way around, but that doesn't matter. You wouldn't have even noticed if I didn't tell you. Okay, let's come across to Exodus chapter 32, where Jono left us at. So before we do that, so we'll come over to Exodus anyway. Exodus chapter 32 is at the end of Moses' 40 days. During the 40 days, he's explaining a lot of important things which Moses needed to know about the running of the nation. One absolute key verse, which is essential for this section, is chapter 29, verse 43. Everyone have a look at this one. Verse 43, "And there I will meet with the children of Israel, and the tabernacle shall be sanctified by my glory." Okay, so what's that saying? Really simply. Tim. Verse 43 of chapter
29. The tabernacle
will
be sanctified by God.
Tabernacle, and then there's God sanctifying it with his glory. Okay, so there's a tabernacle in the middle of the children of Israel. God's glory is there sanctifying it. Verse 45, "And I will dwell among the children of Israel, and I will be their God." Okay, these are special people. We've got a special law for them. I am actually going to be in the middle of them in glory, and I'm going to be their God. Yeah, maybe that's interesting, maybe it's not. We don't quite see the relevance of that here, but trust me, it's quite important for this section. Okay, so that's a key verse. Tabernacle there is the literal tent in the middle of the...
There's a little tree there, it says, "For Israel." It says, "The children of Israel."
Yep.
"Israel shall be sanctified by my glory."
By my glory. Okay, we know from other places that God's glory dwells in the midst of the tabernacle, in the most holy place. So whether it's talking about Israel as a nation or Israel as a specific little tabernacle, as a little tent, it doesn't really matter. But God's glory is going to dwell with them, and he's going to be their God. Okay? Right. Chapter 32. Let's have a look at a few sections about the golden calf. He's still on the mountain. He hasn't got anywhere. And God tells him in verse 9 and 8 and 11 that... he's going to destroy them. Okay? God's going to come out and wipe them off. While he's still got the Ten Commandments in his hand, they break number 1 and number 6. What's number 1? What's number 6? No other gods before me. The golden calf. Number 6? No. Similar. Similar. That's for the first one. Yeah. What's number 6? And the Ten Commandments. What were they doing around the golden calf? Dancing? Adultery. Exactly. "Thou shalt not worship any other gods before me. Thou shalt not commit adultery." Moses got the two tablets of stone in his hands as God tells him he's about to destroy the whole nation. And Moses says, "No, hang on. Don't destroy them. Because of two reasons. The covenant that you've got with God, with covenant with Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, and also, what are the Egyptians going to say? How is your name going to be upheld amongst the Gentiles if you're going to destroy your people which you brought out?" Okay, so they set up this golden calf. They start drinking. Alcohol will definitely have been involved. The latest Egyptian music, they would have brought that out. Okay, the beats would have been going. And as the situation got worse and worse and it got out of control, people started pairing off and were having sex in the temple, in the tabernacle of Israel. Okay, so the situation was terrible. Moses comes down, and then Moses himself, even though he pleads for the people, gets angry. Okay, have a look in verse 20. He grinds the calf to powder, and he chucks it in the water and says, "Drink this." And then he gets all the Levites together and he says, "Come on, boys, let's go throughout the whole place, kill everyone who's guilty of being involved." 3,000 people die that day at the sword of the Levites. Okay, so Moses himself is angry. But then, verse 30, "It came to pass on the morrow that Moses said unto the people, 'Ye have sinned a great sin, and now I will go up unto the Lord. Peradventure I shall make an atonement for sin.'" Moses is the intercessor that we've talked about here. He makes intercession for Israel. Even though he was angry to start with, he says, "Look, I want you to do something." And he's so passionate about it, in verse 32, look what he says. "If you won't forgive their sin, blot me out, I pray thee, out of the book that you've written. If you won't forgive them, blot me out of your book. Take my life for the life of the nation." Now, obviously, God's not going to do that. And God listens to Moses here. He makes intercession, and a successful intercession. And he says, "All right, Moses, I'm going to listen to you." And the only thing that I'm not going to do is that I'm not going to come with you anymore. Verse 34, he's going to send an angel. "Now therefore go and lead unto the people the place where I have spoken thee. Behold, mine angel shall go before thee. Nevertheless, the day when I will visit their sin upon them." So he's saying, "Look, we haven't forgotten about it, but for the moment, I'm still going to go ahead with the plan. I'm going to send my angel." Okay, verse 33 and at verse 11. Moses has developed this amazing relationship with God. God at the moment isn't living in Israel. Okay, God isn't happy with the people. They've set up a tent outside the camp. Okay, God is literally there, and Moses is speaking with him, as it says in verse 11, or at least when I say God is literally there, God's representative, which would be what we'd call the Yahweh angel, possibly Michael the archangel. "And Yahweh spake unto Moses face to face as a man speaks unto his friend." So Moses has this incredible close relationship with God. Okay? And then as the conversation progresses, he starts talking about the fact that he really like God himself to go with them. Verse 14, we have the answer, and he says, "My presence shall go with thee, and I will give thee rest." Verse 17, "And Yahweh said unto Moses, I will do this thing also that thou hast spoken, for thou hast found grace in my sight, and I know thee by name." So we're talking about Moses as the intercessor. Moses stops the whole nation from being completely destroyed. And then also Moses succeeds in getting God himself to dwell with the people, which he wasn't doing. He was living outside in a tent. What Moses wants is he wants the glory of God to be shining in the temple as an assurance, or the tabernacle as an assurance. He says to him in verse 18, "Please God, show me your glory." Okay, God agrees. In verse 19, he says, "Okay, I'll do that, and actually I'll make my goodness pass before you as well, and I'll proclaim the name." Okay, but just bear in mind, with my glory, it could kill you. So what I'm going to do is I'm not going to show you my full glory, because if I did, you'd just be evaporated. So what I'm going to do, in symbol, I'm going to hold my hand there so you can't really see my full glory. And also I'm going to just show you my back parts. Okay, so he's kind of giving a little bit of a mental picture about exactly what he's going to do. He's going to stand in the cleft of a rock in verse 22, and I'll cover you with my hand and I'll pass by. Okay? And you won't actually see my face. You'll just see my back parts. Okay, then we get to the actual description of what happens. 34, verse 5 and 6. So we are going somewhere with this. We're not just looking at Moses' life for the sake of looking at Moses' life. This is part of our contrast and comparison with Elijah. The narrative story. Verse 5, "And Yahweh descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of Yahweh. And Yahweh passed by before him and proclaimed, Yahweh, Yahweh Elohim, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children, upon the children's children, unto the third and fourth generation. And Moses made haste and bowed down his head toward the earth and worshipped. Okay, so we're given his name, which is Yahweh, which is all about God's purpose. We're given his character, which follows that, tells exactly what God is and how he likes to deal with people. He's merciful, but he doesn't let people get away with everything forever. He will visit iniquity. What we don't see is anything about this process, anything about him holding his hand and showing his glory and him just seeing the back parts. It's completely left out because it's not important. So can we assume then he didn't actually show him the glory? We'll have a look at verse 29. And it came to pass when Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tables of testimony in his hands that the skin of his face shone while he talked with him. So it's like God did show him his glory, and his glory radiated towards Moses so much that when he came back down from the mountain, he was actually radiating out God's glory. So I believe there is a physical aspect to this as well, but the record doesn't talk about it because it's not important. What Moses was thinking is that if he saw God's character, if he saw God's glory, he'd be really encouraged. Okay? What does God actually do instead? And how does it help him? As well, sorry. What does he focus on?
Explain his name and purpose.
Exactly. Okay, so how is that going to help him with what he needs to do, lead the children of Israel? Thinking about what's just happened. Probably a little bit of a hard question.
God was going to destroy the people.
Yep.
And Moses has pleaded on behalf of the people.
Yep.
And God has heard Moses' cry.
Yep.
And said, I'm not going to destroy these people. And then he's shown him what he actually is like. And so Moses knows that he is a God that's gracious with mercy, because he just demonstrated.
Yep.
He just heard what Moses had to say, and he just... he changed his mind, but he showed compassion and forgiveness.
Good. So essentially, you can rely on God. You can rely on his characteristics and that he's going to look after you. So if you're going to have a God who's going to lead you to the promised land, one really important thing to understand and to know about that God is how he deals with people and how he works with them to develop his character in them. Okay, he's not just going to just wipe them all out. He actually really wants to, and he knew that Moses would plead with him to help these people. He wants them to love him. He wants them to love their neighbours, and he wants people to understand how he wants to interact. Okay, so really important lesson for Moses to learn in all that. So the important thing is not the glory, although the glory is there. The important thing is God's character. That's what you can really rely on. Okay, so Moses has this amazing balance and perspective on the whole situation. He really understands who God is, and he understands when he should plead, and he even understands when there's need for punishment. He sends out the Levites. Okay, so Moses is this amazing person, and God speaks to him as a friend, and that says an enormous amount about testament to his character. Okay, now we can come back to Elijah. So as John has shown, the pictures of the desert, that's exactly the type of landscape he was in. Absolute barren desert. The mountain of Horeb and Sinai is this big rocky outcrop which sticks out over a flattish sort of plain. So 1 Kings chapter 19. Okay. And he came thither unto a cave and lodged there. And behold, the word of Yahweh came unto him and said unto him, what doest thou here, Elijah? Okay, so he's in a cave. Have we got a similarity? What's our similarity?
Gone. Gone away.
Hey? Yep.
Moses went up and down.
Yep.
And he was hidden where? Cleft of rock.
Caves.
Okay? So it's exactly the same. This is in the comparison section, so that's probably not the best idea. But they're in the same, pretty much the same place. He's in a cave or in the cleft of a rock.
Yeah, okay. Trevor Maher said, I was listening to his talk last night, he said some translations even say that he came to the cave.
The cave, exactly. So it's a cave that people know about or is in the Bible narration already.
So he's at the cave. Exactly the same thing has happened. He spent 40 days, okay, thinking about things. He's in a cave, and then he goes on in verse 10. And he said, I have been very jealous for Yahweh, God of armies, for the children of Israel, forsaken thy covenant, throw down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with a sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away. What's the theme of his little statement or prayer there? Him. Totally focused on himself. He's had 40 days to think, hasn't he? He's had 40 days to think about the answer to this question, and this is what he comes up with. It's all about me. I'm the only one left. I'm the only prophet. Everyone else is dead. It all depends on me. And you know what? They want to kill me. They want to take my life away. And at the same time as sort of saying, oh, it's all me, it's all me, he's sort of pushing them down as well. He's saying, they have destroyed exactly what it says in Romans chapter 11. They have done destroying the elders, killed the prophets, and I only am left. He's telling on the children of Israel, isn't he? He's telling on his brothers and sisters. He wants God to do something about it. He's not just saying it just because it's part of the story. He's actually saying, God, I'm here because of something I remember that you said to Moses, and I want these people destroyed. That's why I'm here. And this is responding to the question, what are you doing here, Elijah? Okay, so what happens next is that Yahweh passes by. Now, where is another similarity? So what do we have here? Cleft, cave, pass by. What happened with Moses? Good answer. Passed by.
What's a cleft?
Okay, like a fissure.
So, assume we've got a big. Okay, non-technical people. Got a big cliff, okay, and then you've got some sort of gap in the cliff. So that's like a little space, which could be a crack, if you like. So yeah, in effect, it is a cave. So it's just like an area inside the cliff. All right. So what happens is that God passes by, okay, and he's done the same already with Moses. And he passes by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountain and break in pieces the rocks before Yahweh. But Yahweh was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But Yahweh was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But Yahweh was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still, small voice. Okay, so we've got this wind. It picks up massive boulders. It smashes them against the cliff, completely shattering massive boulders that no one could actually move. We've got the earthquake. He's hiding in the back of the cave by this stage, absolutely petrified. Solid rock is just moving, the floor's touching the roof, and he's just sort of hiding in the back of the cave, cowering. And then it's silent again. And then after that, you've got the fire. So it could be lava pouring out of the mountain. It could be like a massive bushfire burning on nothing, just all over the place. So it's just this massive amount of energy being expended on this miracle. And it's all for the benefit of Elijah. It says Yahweh was not in the wind. Does that mean it's some kind of naturally occurring disaster? So it was just a coincidence that there was an earthquake, wind and fire all at the same time? Because God wasn't in them, we're told. No. Nick's shaking his head, no. What it's actually saying is that it's not really what God is all about. God doesn't really have... Absolutely. So the suggestion that it may have been a natural disaster is obviously not too coincidental to be true. So it's God is in it in the sense that it's His Holy Spirit that's created it, but He's not in it in the sense of He doesn't really achieve anything by it. Although, and we'll get to this in a little bit later, He actually does use it because it is a useful tool. All right, so basically what's happened here is a parable of Elijah himself and Elijah's ministry. Elijah was a little bit like the wind, the fire and the earthquake. He sort of come in and he blew the doors open when he came into Ahab's palace. The drought that he pronounced was like an earthquake, just big, massive event. The fire, that speaks for itself, doesn't even need the comparison. He sent fire and burned up the image. So Elijah's very much about these type of things. What was going to symbolise the next phase of Elijah's ministry? Still, small whisper. Rotherham translates the still small voice, the voice of a gentle whisper. So what God was telling Elijah when he came to Mount Horeb is, you've done all these things, you've done all these big miracles, I can work with them. This power that you've just seen me display, I could have easily used that against Israel and completely wiped them out, but it's not my purpose at this time. What I want you to do, Elijah, is I want you to go out and to speak to people. So what happens after he hears that still small voice? Where is he when he hears that still small voice? Ross up.
Can I just make a comparison with Moses?
Go for it.
The fire, the wind, and the earthquake. Just in Exodus chapter 19.
Yep.
It's not exactly the same, but it's very similar. Instead of a wind, you've got a storm.
Yep.
But it basically goes through exactly that same thing, and at the end, where it says in verse 19, and when the voice of the trumpet sounded long and waxed louder and louder, Moses spake and God answered him by a voice.
Yep.
It's basically God displayed to the children of Israel all His mighty acts of power, but in the end it was God who was responding to the voice of Moses.
Very good. Well, thank you. Okay, so what we've got here is Elijah, after he witnesses these miracles, frozen in terror. He's at the back of the cave, too scared to move. After he hears, only after he hears this gentle whisper, does he dare venture out. Okay? This is what the 7,000 people in Israel needed. Elijah comes to the cave, and he comes to hear, and he comes to learn. The 7,000 people to be called out of a corrupt nation need someone to approach them, to talk to them, to encourage them, so they can come to God. So Elijah's asked the question again, and this time he's learnt the lesson. Do you understand, Elijah? Do you understand exactly what I'm trying to say with this earthquake, wind and fire and still small voice business? Yep, I've got it. I understand. Thanks very much for the lesson. So, what are you doing here, Elijah? And what does he say? I have been very jealous for Yahweh, God of armies, because the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenants. Exactly the same thing. He goes and repeats his statement. So it's obviously something that he's already pre-prepared. That's the only thing he can think of. His mind isn't sort of really working. I reckon he said it differently the second time. He wouldn't have been as confident as, let's kill Israel. Just, oh, this is why I think Israel needs to really be maybe destroyed. He hadn't understood, had he? So what does God say to him? Well, first of all, what doesn't he understand? What he doesn't understand is God's purpose and his purpose with saving individuals. Okay, he really doesn't understand that at all. Individuals actually mean something to God. What God didn't want Elijah to do was go around scorching people and blowing them backwards with wind and shaking them down with earthquakes. God wanted them to go out and touch people, to talk to them about the kingdom, to encourage them. And this is something that Moses was very good at. Moses knew how God wanted to work with the people, and he pleaded with the people. So Moses was much better at sort of understanding the big picture. Go for it.
Something too, that it wasn't just here that God had said, try to teach Elijah about the voice, because That's why he sent him to the widow of Zarephath.
Absolutely.
That's why he sent, what was that guy? The guy that was Ahab's second-hand man.
Yep.
Obadiah.
Yeah.
And his reaction to those people weren't the way he shouldn't have. Like he was still, he overlooked that those two amazing people, even in them. So it's something that God tried to push his whole ministry.
Yep. And it's a lesson he's still learning. Even when the still small voice is there, he still isn't picking it up. So it's a work in progress. Okay, very good point. All right, so a still small voice. How does a still small voice even work? If I whispered to you all with a still small voice, the guys at the back wouldn't hear. So what has to happen is if I use my still small voice, is you all have to come in close, okay? You're going to come in and we're going to open the Bible. We're going to be talking about it. We're going to discuss it. We're going to all get excited and encouraged by quiet reasoning from the Word of God. That's how the still small voice works. Elijah wasn't very comfortable with that. He wasn't comfortable with dealing with individuals one-on-one. He didn't really like touching people. Okay? He didn't like lending the shoulder to cry on. He didn't really like getting those hands dirty. He didn't mind the big things. He didn't mind being up front and digging a trench and calling down fire from heaven. But what he was uncomfortable with is going talking to the old lady and really empathising and getting down to her level. That's something Elisha was very good at. Okay, and that's why God later on pairs them up together. So it's a lesson we can learn as well. Go out and put yourself out there. Put yourself out of your comfort zone. Try and help people that will need your help. It's how God works. Okay, we could go out there. We could do a massive, big lecture, big sort of aggressive campaign, and get a lot of interest. But the interest soon fades unless there's consistent. Friendly conversation that we can have with people. Okay, so Elijah doesn't understand this. Elijah, I've got some news for you. You're sacked. What do you mean? I'm the only one left in the whole of Israel and you're going to sack me? What are you thinking? Elijah, you just don't get it, do you? What I want you to do is to anoint a prophet, and not just anoint a prophet, but in verse 16, anoint Elisha to be prophet in your room. You're going to anoint him. He's going to take your place. Elijah isn't going to have a public ministry from now on. And by the way, Elijah, the people aren't going to go unpunished. I'm not that kind of God. Eventually, the people, I'll need to do something about it. The time isn't now, though. What I'm actually going to do, I'm going to bring earthquake, wind and fire. I'm going to bring the earthquake, or however we want to you put the order. Hazael, the king of Syria, okay? He was going to be a massive wind. He was going to absolutely obliterate Israel for the evil that they've done. And before he does that, the fire of Jehu is going to come in. He's going to kill every single living relative of Ahab, and he's also going to destroy a lot of the worshippers of Baal. And then just in case we need someone else, Elijah's also there to catch anyone who falls through. Let's read that in verse 17. It shall come to pass that him that escapeth the sword of Hazael shall Jehu slay, and him that escapeth from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay. So Elisha was prepared to be the backup, but Jehu was pretty effective, and Elisha didn't actually even need to kill anyone. Okay, so does that make sense? Is everyone sort of happy with that? So we have only got 5 minutes left, and I need to deal with another section. So we're running out of time, but I do have this really good quote in Isaiah chapter 29. Could we skip? Let's ask Nick. Could we skip the last section? Or maybe I could do it in like 2 minutes and get the main points out of it, because this one in Isaiah 29 is really quite interesting. Let's come back to Isaiah 29. All right, so we finished the story. Okay, that's the story of 1 Kings 19 over. We're not going back to have a look at it in any detail. Just want to have a look at the idea of God using judgment. Okay, so I was interested in earthquake, wind and fire. So what do you do when you're interested in earthquake, wind and fire and you're doing Bible study?
Diving into Esau.
Diving into Esau. look up, all the times earthquake, wind and fire were mentioned. I finally came across a passage which had earthquake, wind and fire in it. I thought, oh, that's quite interesting. Let's have a look at that. So let's have a look at it now. Isaiah chapter 29, verse 6. Everyone there? It's a good one. Thou shalt be visited of Yahweh of hosts with thunder and with earthquake and with great noise and with storm and with tempest and the flame of devouring fire. Okay, so it's got all the elements that you'd want in a typical Elijah destruction. What's it talking about? Any ideas?
Judgment on Ariel.
Judgment on Ariel? Who's Ariel? Exactly. So it's the tribe of Judah. It's David's city. Okay? When did that happen? When did this judgment prophesied here happen? Babylon. Good answer, Jono.
Exactly.
Okay? So it happened at the time of Babylon. So this is a prophecy of the destruction. Why did it happen? Verse 13. Wherefore, the Lord said, for as much as this people draw near me with their mouth and with their lips to honour me, but they have removed their heart far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by the precept of men. That's a quote that Jesus quotes, talking of the scribes and Pharisees. These people are bad, okay? God can't deal with them anymore. These people are way beyond God's help. They pretend, but they don't actually worship with their heart. As a result, earthquake, wind, and fire completely wiped them off. What happened at the time of Jesus? Those people who had exactly the same attitude, what happened to them? Earthquake, wind, and fire in the form of... Hey?
Roman army.
AD 70. Completely wiped them off of the face of the earth. Our time today... Is it any better? Hey?
China.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolute mess. God is going to do exactly the same thing today. He's going to put out earthquake, wind and fire when he can't work with people. Okay? Come over and look at Isaiah chapter 30. It doesn't have all the exact same things. I did an exhort and I tried to fit in all the different things, but you kind of, one thing is like the shaking of a spear, so I kind of said that's the shaking of the earthquake. It was a little bit sketchy, but it's got most of it. It's got fire, and it's definitely got wind and brimstone and stuff. So from verse 37, this is talking about our times. Behold, this is verse chapter 30. The name of Yahweh comes from far, burning in anger and stuff. And there'll be lightnings in verse 30, and he's going to be angry, and hailstones, and Tophet shall be ordained of old, verse 30, and there's going to be fire and much wood, and the breath of Yahweh is like a stream of brimstone that doth kindle it. Okay, so this is our time. I don't have time to prove that to you, but just believe me, this is the time of Armageddon, okay? Earthquake, wind, and fire, all right? So at that point, I'm sure, has gone home. Now, for it to be really interesting, this whole section, and what I was looking for is another Elijah link. What would be really nice? Still small voice. Okay, so I looked, I had a bit of a look for it, and I found it. Okay. Verse 18. Let's have a look. What Bible study is all about. Have a bit of a look, and if you find it, it's very exciting. All right, verse 18. And therefore, Yahweh will wait that he will be gracious and that he will have mercy upon you. So this is what God really wants to do. He wants to show his character. He wants to show graciousness, and he wants to show mercy. Verse 19. The people that dwell at Zion shall weep no more. Everyone is going to have their tears dried up. Verse 20. Though Yahweh give you the bread of affliction and the water of adversity, yet thy teachers shall not be moved into a corner any more, but thy eyes shall see thy teachers. No longer is the prophet going to be slain like they were in Israel. The prophet's actually going to be able to come out, and he's going to be able to speak to the people and to teach them. And remember, this is the time of the kingdom. That prophet is going to be us. Verse 21. Look what we will say to people in the time of the kingdom. and thine ears shall hear a word behind thee, saying, this is the way, walk ye in it, when you turn to the right hand and when you turn to the left. The still, small voice, working in the time of the kingdom. So there's going to be earthquake, there's going to be wind, there's going to be fire, a lot of people are going to be destroyed, but we are going to be proclaiming the still, small voice. This is the way, I want you to walk in it. Okay. All right, so really quickly, I'll just completely summarise what happens in 2 Kings chapter 1 is that Ahaziah is up on his roof. There's a little skylight. He steps on it. He falls through to the bottom story. He's got massive internal injuries, and he's laying on his bed thinking he's going to die. He then says, what I might do, I wouldn't mind finding out if I'm actually going to die. I'm going to go and ask Beelzebub, who's like the god of healing, a local Philistine god, and see if he can help me. I don't know if it actually is Beelzebub. It's something that sounds like Beelzebub. It is? Yeah, so it's actually called the god of the flies, but apparently also one of his meanings is like god of medicine or something. So he goes and his messengers are on the way to find out, and Elijah interrupts. Okay, he says, hang on. Is it because there's no God in Israel that you're asking of some random local Philistine God? I'm going to tell you, as God, the answer to your question, yes, you're going to die. Okay? Well, thanks very much, Elijah. Go back, tell him, okay, you're going to die. Who told you that? I don't know. What did he look like? He was a rough man with a rough leather coat and had a girdle and camel hair coat, wasn't it? Leather girdle tied around. That's Elijah. Okay, go and get him. Now, the reason I believe that he wanted to get Elijah is he wanted to kill him. If you're going to die anyway, and he probably thought he was going to die, someone's bringing you bad news like, you're going to die, well, you're going to die too, and we'll all be happy. Okay, so Elijah's sitting on top of a hill. He's sitting on top of a hill, just sort of chilling out, as you did in those days, and 51 people come up to him. A man and his captain of... He was a captain of 50 and his 50 people. And he quite rudely says, man of God, come down. Okay? And Elijah says, if I be a man of God, then fire is going to come down from heaven and it's going to consume you and your 50. Okay? And fire does come down. Messengers come back to the king and they say, where's Elijah? And he said, well, the 50 people, they got burnt. What? Go and send another 50 people out. Okay, so captain of 50 goes up to Elijah again, stands at the bottom of the hill and says, man of God, come down. The king wants to speak to you. Same process. If I be a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50. All right, so it happens again. People are starting to hear about it. The whole nation would eventually hear about it. Finally, a captain of 50 who has a few brains comes along and he says... He walks up to the top of the hill and he bows down and says to Elijah, look, I pray you, let the life of your servant be precious in your eyes and my 50 men. Please, if you don't mind, I know what's happened to the other 50, I don't want to make the same mistake. Please, if we can just sort of work something out here. God intervenes and says, I want you to go down and speak to Ahaziah and tell him he's going to die. So Elijah goes down, speaks to Ahaziah, tells him he's going to die, and that's the end of the story. Okay? What a random story. Yep, that's not the end of the lessons though. Three lessons that we can get out of it. Okay? Why does this happen? First of all, the person who acts faithfully, the faithful captain, if your heart is right, you're going to act differently to other people. Okay? God's going to notice that, and God's going to respond. Was he one of the 7,000 people who didn't bow the knee? Or was he convinced by Elijah's rather convincing fire throwing down from heaven? Okay? That would obviously be an incentive to start believing. So we're not quite sure. So one lesson, faithfulness. The second one, the king. Why does this story happen? Well, he's an important person. As I said, everyone would find out about it and they'd hear. He's a willingly ignorant, stubborn idolater right to the end. He should have known better, but his mind was just set on evil. He had nothing else to live for. He could have repented, but he goes down to the grave unbelieving. He has an unhappy, unfulfilled, selfish life, and that's it. He actually wants to kill his only point of contact with God. so you have no contact at all. Right, so that's why we sort of see the story, because it's a lesson to people. But what's the question you should all be asking? Elijah. What's Elijah's frame of mind at this time? What do you reckon? How do you slip back into some old habits? Remember, this is after the story of Mount Horeb. How do you slip back into some old habits of condemning people?
Doesn't seem real compassionate. Think of yourself again.
What was that? Starting to think of himself? You know what? If you're expecting an answer, you're not going to get one, because the chapter leaves it very unconcluded, doesn't it? So we don't actually have an answer on that one. It leaves us guessing. What was that?
Still reckon something.
I reckon it's the same thing. It's good. Actually, if God doesn't agree with it,
yep.
He never allowed the fire to come down from heaven.
One thing we know for sure is that God agreed with it, okay? For the first two. What do you reckon would have happened if God didn't intervene with a captain who is on his knees? We don't know. Okay, so that's the grey area. Elijah may have burned him down with fire anyway. So we're not sure. God spares him. So that's something that we'll have to wait for the kingdom to find out. Okay, so just in conclusion, Mount Horeb taught him some lessons, but it was going to take him years for them to learn. We're not sure here if he'd learnt the lesson, but we know for sure that in the kingdom he's going to have learned his lesson, because he's going to bring the children of Israel back into the land of Israel, who are scattered throughout, using the still small voice. Okay, so although he was flawed, although he had passions just like us, God works with him. God works hard to get everyone to develop his love and his character. And we need to learn the lesson of the still small voice, respond to it, act on it, and let our voice be the still small voice to others.